activity. And so, and we found that that graphene conductivity is of the order of E squared over H, and it is independent on the strength of disorder. So now, if you recall localization, right, and if you recall the scaling theory of localization, right, so there we essentially argued that that the localization gives rise to the flow of the conductance, right, and the dimensionless conductance flow with the system size is described by some single parameter scaling by some beta function, as you hopefully remember, in two spatial dimensions, this beta function is always negative, and it goes as a, so at large conductance, it goes as minus one over G, right? So from this formula, you would expect that since dimensionless conductance of graphene is of the order one, right, you would expect this beta function for graphene to be of the order minus one. Okay, so then you would you know, by just looking at this equation, you would say, okay, so this means that log G is some constant minus log L, right? So from which you would say that that localization should be very, very important, and G of L should go as 1 over L, right? So really the conductivity should become scale dependent. Turns out that this is wrong, right? So for the case of graphene, this is wrong. And conductance remains of the order of the E squared over H, even if you increase the scale, right? So this tells you that the localization works differently here. And the question is why, right? So essentially, this is because of the spinner structure of the wave functions, essentially it's because the geometry of these wave functions is different, right? So let's understand this, and let's start with a very simple example, right? So let's consider Dirac fermions in the presence of the potential barrier. And so, and we will see that because they have pseudo spin, right? Which is, you know, you can think about it by analogy with usual spin 1/2. Because they have pseudo spin, their scattering of a potential barrier is very different from the conventional non-relativistic electrons.
So Dirac fermions with potential barrier.
So first let's approach this problem perturbatively, and let's consider potential, right, which is just a function of coordinate x, let's ask what is in the lowest order of perturbation theory, what is the probability to backscatter of a barrier. Okay, so let us send a wave with some momentum k on the barrier, right? So this would be v of x, and k would be equal to kx0, right? So I want to send it along x-axis. And let's ask what is the probability to backscatter so that its momentum becomes minus kx0. So in the lowest order, I know that essentially backscattering probability is determined by the matrix element, right, of my potential between the incoming and outgoing wave, right? Now, let me write down this state, right? So state k, to find it, I need to solve the following equation, right? H v Fermi, 0 kx, kx 0, k should be equal to H v Fermi, kx k, right? This tells me that the solution should be simply 1-1, right? So I can, this would tell me that the pseudo spin is pointing along plus x axis, right? So if I think about this spinner as effective spin 1/2, right, this would tell me that the spin is pointing along x, right? So pseudo spin parallel to x. Now, if I do the same for the reflected wave, I would find that doing the same steps, I would find that it looks quite similar, except the pseudo spin is now pointing in the opposite direction, right? So it's again aligned with the momentum. Okay, and so and from this you see that if my potential is a scalar, right? So if it's proportional to a unity matrix, this matrix element would be always zero, right? Because it involves overlap between pseudo spin pointing along x and minus x, right? So it's always zero. So you see that, and clearly, right, this is not going to change if you go to any order in perturbation theory.
Sorry, how can we see that they'll have those spins? How can we read off the pseudo spins from? So how do you know that minus k, for example, has that pseudo spin?
This pseudo spin.
Yes.
Okay, very good. So what I need to do, right? So I have my effective Hamiltonian. So all I need to do is solve this equation for eigenvalues, right, and eigenvectors. And you can do it generally, right? So if I wanted to, let me actually solve a more general problem, right? So let me find eigenvector eigenfunction for a momentum which is pointing in some arbitrary direction at an angle theta with respect to the x-axis, right? Okay, so then let me write down my Hamiltonian HK. Plus IKY, right? So then I can, or no, we picked it like this, right? So then just plugging this in here, I'll get H V Fermi K e to the minus I theta, right? And here I'll get K e to the plus I theta, okay? So now I need to solve an equation HK acting on some spinner UK VK should be equal to epsilon of K UK VK. Right? So it's like you can think about this equation. There is some pre-factor, right? But this is really nothing but a magnetic field in the XY plane, right? At an angle theta, right? So I know that my pseudospin should be pointing along the magnetic field, right? So then I can right away write the solution and say that UK VK should be pointing in the XY plane, right? And then I know that it looks like that. So it should be 1 e to the I theta, right? Right? So this is, you can check that this is a solution, right? This would be solution with positive energy, and if I want solution with a negative energy, I need to write a minus here, right? So now you see, if you apply this answer to the incoming and reflected wave, right? Incoming wave has theta equals 0, so it's 1, 1. Reflected wave has theta equal pi, so it's 1, -1. Right? Make sense? Okay, good. So. Right, so you see that pseudospin plays a very important role, right? So it makes this quasi particles. It essentially suppresses backscattering greatly, right? Already you can see it looking at the example of a single impurity, essentially. So and we could go further, right? And we could really try to solve a problem, you know, of Dirac fermion, which is confined by some big barrier, right? So let's solve the following problem. So let's say that there is a potential step, let's say of the following form. So V naught hyperbolic tangent of x over d, okay? So it looks like that. And let me send some particle at some angle theta at the barrier. Okay, so it will come if theta equals 0, then it would come essentially at a normal incidence, right, along x, or it could come at some angle. And let me find the transmission, right? So if I was dealing with standard non-relativistic electrons, right, I know that this barrier is very high, so I would always get reflected, right? So but here it's not the case. So here you'll see that near normal incidence, you would go through with probability 1. Okay, so it's a bit counterintuitive, but in a second we will understand where this comes from. So how should we approach this problem? So let's to make things easier. So let's assume that this barrier is smooth, and let's use quasi-classical approximation. Okay, so if I look at it from the top, right? So let me plot it in the coordinates. Let me look at it from the top, right? Then my electron comes at an angle theta, right? And for simplicity, let me assume that it comes with zero energy, right? It would just make our calculations easier. So what does it mean? So energy of the electron at minus infinity should be zero, right? But on the other hand, I could say that this energy is equal to the to the potential energy plus kinetic energy, and this is minus V naught, right, plus H V times K naught, right? So, and this is zero. So then from this I can relate K naught to the V naught. HV Fermi, right? Okay, so now if I look at the total energy of the electron near this barrier, you would find that there is a classically forbidden region, right? So energy is just this, right? So it's V naught tangent x over d plus, so let's take into account that the momentum, that the y momentum is conserved and cannot change, right? So this is just a constant, but kx momentum can change, right? So as I approach the barrier, it will become smaller because I have to give up some kinetic energy for the potential energy that I am winning, right? And I can find classical turning points by saying that kx should become zero, right? So classical turning points are found if I say that V naught star over D plus H V Fermi K naught should be zero. So, and just because I would just want an estimate, let me approximate this term by just this one, right? Which would be true if x star over d is much smaller than 1. Over V naught. And now let me simplify things by taking this relation between K naught and V naught into account. Okay, so then I would just get, I think I lost something here. I lost a factor of sine theta here. Then you see that x star becomes just d times sine theta. Okay? So those are my turning points, right? Classical turning points. Right, so this region between minus x star and plus x star is classically forbidden, and in order to go through, electron must tunnel quantum mechanically, and I can find tunneling probability and it's going to be a function of the incidence angle, so it's going to be e to the minus twice the classical action, and the classical action will be integral of minus x star to x star k absolute value of the imaginary momentum, right, times dx. And I can do this integral. So I need to integrate from minus d sine theta to d sine theta. And I can just, right, I can obtain the imaginary momentum from this formula. Right, so, and once I do that, so what I find is, right, so after I do this integral, I find the following. Okay. Let me actually write it more clearly. So it's pi d k naught sine squared theta over 2. So, and now I have my answer, right? So now I can write down the quasi-classical transmission probability. So which would be just an exponential of minus pi k naught d sine squared theta. So this is a very interesting answer, because what it tells us is that let me plot this probability as a function of the incidence angle. Right, you see that when theta is equal 0, this transmission probability is 1. Right? And then it remains of the order 1 in the interval of angles delta theta, which is given by 1 over square root k0 dp. Okay, so you see that if you come at a at an incidence angle which is close to normal, right, you always get transmitted, right? So which is quite different from the normal electrons, right? And this also tells you that even if you have very strong disorder, right, still you cannot trap this Dirac electrons there, right? Because sometimes they would come at a normal incidence and they would always leak out, right? Right, so this suggests that the Dirac electrons should localize differently as compared to normal electrons. So this is so far quite suggestive, right? But really, to understand what's going on, we need to go ahead and study quantum corrections to the conductivity for the Dirac particles. Okay, so essentially, we should reconsider pictures that we developed with the perturbative quantum corrections due to interference of different loops, right, and see where it goes wrong. Right, so generally we call this quantum corrections weak localization corrections. But as we will see in a second, in this case, actually, there are additional phases which should be taken into account for this interference process, which turn the localization into anti-localization. And this, yeah?
after calculating the classical turning point, you make a drawing on the middle board with the dashes.
Yes.
What are you drawing there?
So this is classically forbidden region.
Okay.
Right. So electron has to tunnel through this region to go across.
But isn't the whole, and why isn't the whole part derived from it?
Uh-huh. So, well, you later on, of course, you know, you need to find a region in which Kx should become imaginary, right? Mm-hmm. So if you look at this equation, right, if I go, you see, this is actually a good point, right? So if I go to this region, I could pick a different solution here, right? I could pick a solution with the negative sign, right? Which would be, so I started out with an electron sitting somewhere here, right, in the conduction band, but I could also put an electron here, right, in the valence band. And then what I need to do, I need to change the sign of the kinetic energy, right? So that's why the whole thing is symmetric, right, with respect to changing sign of x, right? So this is a good question. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Where is this potential from?
Well, that's a good question. So. Right now is just something I wish to consider. So, but in general, you always have some potential due to disorder. Right. So, really, you should usually understand what kind of disorder you have, what kind of potential it produces, and how your carriers scatter off this potential. No, don't take it literally. So of course, as we usually do, right? I consider the simple problem, right? Which is nevertheless very very telling, right? So if I have, you know, because I learned that if potential profile looks like that, right? So if it's constant along y, right? Then electrons always go through. If they fall perpendicular to the barrier. Now, in real life setting, of course, I would have some, you know, potential profile would follow some lines which are not straight. But still, I know that if I come at a normal incidence, I cannot backscatter, right? So there is always some probability that I would come at normal at a normal incidence, and then I would go through with probability one, right?
Which is normal to the disorder surface. Well.
Okay, so think about it like this. So, question I want to answer, right? So, you have your sample and you have some disorder profile, right? So, if I'm thinking about usual electrons. Right, if I have some very strong disorder, which is, you know, let's say very very negative here, and positive here, right? Then I know that my electron states would get trapped here, so I get localized states, right, which cannot carry current. Right, in this case, you see that this is not the case, right? In this case, you see that they would always leak somehow slowly, right, when they come at a normal. At the normal incidence. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So because we have relativistic electrons, the transmission probability that is one at theta is equal to zero, does it have to do with the conservation of chirality?
Yes.
So yeah, okay.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Okay, so if you backscatter, you don't conserve. You clearly do not conserve chirality. So
yes. Exactly.
Fit, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So this was. I mean, this was essentially our argument above, right? This perturbative argument that essentially scalar potential does not couple to the pseudo spin, right? Or to chirality, if you want to call it that, right? So, which tells you that potential disorder can never take you between, essentially that it can never backscatter, right? Because incident and exactly backscatter state have opposite pseudo spins, right? But if you are falling at some angle other than normal, right, there is some overlap of the pseudo spin, let's say here and here, right? So then backscattering becomes possible. And so what we did, right, we found essentially probability to get transmitted or probability to get backscattered depending on the incidence angle. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Sorry, I might have missed this, but what happened to kx in your derivation?
To kx here?
Yeah.
Well, kx, you see, what happens to kx is that here, right, it becomes zero. And after that, it becomes imaginary. And, you know, from quasi-classics, I know that I need to find essentially classical action under the barrier, right? And that's how I find the probability to tunnel through some barrier, through some classically forbidden region, right?
Sorry, I don't. Why does it become zero?
So, you mean you would like to see it from this formula? No, what happens? So what happens if you send, you know, let's go back to the usual, you know, usual quantum mechanics, right? So let's say you take a potential barrier. You take a potential barrier and you send an electron with some energy which is below the height of this barrier, right? Then energy is just kx squared over 2m plus v of x, right? Now, energy should be conserved, right? So for a while, I can just decrease my momentum and gain some potential energy, right? But then when I come to the point where v of x star is e, right, I know that my classical momentum should vanish, and I can only go through by quantum tunneling, right? So it really becomes not classical process. So I did exactly the same here, right? Except I have a slightly more complicated Hamiltonian. Right, so but this is my kinetic energy. Except in this case, my kinetic energy depends on the incidence angle. Right, so you can view it as a. It becomes like a massive, relativistic one-dimensional, kinetic energy with a mass. That depends on the incidence angle, right? Make sense? Okay, good. So, essentially, now our goal is to understand why for the case of these Dirac particles, weak localization turns into weak anti-localization. Let's recall that this quantum localization, quantum correction effects came from the interference of trajectories which look like that. So you start in some point, you scatter off impurities, and then you come back, then you return to where you started. And this trajectory has had a time reversal partner, right, which is covers the same path but in the opposite direction. And by time reversal invariants, we knew that their quantum mechanical phases should be exactly the same. That's why they interfered constructively. So now, when we're dealing with Dirac fermions, what we have to take into account is that when enclosing this loop, electrons quasi-momentum encloses some path in the momentum space. And turns out that there is a geometric phase which is associated with it. Okay, so which is also called called Berry's phase. So now let me ask you guys. So how many of you are familiar with the Berry's phases? Uh-huh. Okay, everyone or? Oh, okay. So then let's review this. Berry's phases relatively briefly, and then we will spend some more time on them because actually it is really these geometrical phases which underlie all sorts of topological phenomena such as quantum Hall effect. So we will need it later. But let's start with a very simple introduction. And let's consider very general situation. So let's consider some brilliant zone and let's put an electron with some quasi-momentum k naught, and let's move it around, and let's move it around adiabatically. So we could imagine doing that, let's say by applying some very small force, right, which I would design in such a way that the electron comes back to where it started. You can see immediately the connection with our disorder problem, right? Because here disorder does its job, right, and moves electron in the brilliant zone. So and let's ask how does the wave function change as I enclose this loop? So first of all, let me denote the Bloch states by psi k, right? So those would be eigenstates in a given band. So h psi k should be epsilon of k psi k. And by the adiabatic theorem, I know that when I'm moving along this loop, right, at each point, I should stay in the eigenstate, right? That's what the adiabatic theorem tells me. But I can pick up a phase, right? So my time-dependent wave function should be given by the phase, which depends on time, times this eigenstate for the instant value of momentum, right? So I essentially parameterize this loop by the function k of t. Now let me find this phase. And so notice that in a In a trivial situation, I would just say, okay, this phase is just the dynamical phase. It's just the integral of the energy over time, right? But it's not all there is to it. So let's just go by the definition, and let's say that, let's use Schrödinger equation. Okay, so let me just plug this one here. And then I would get that IH d by dt to the I phi psi k of t equals H acting on e to the I phi psi k of t. But the Hamiltonian doesn't care about the phase, right? So this becomes just e to the I phi times the energy at a given instance of time, psi k of t. Okay? So now let me simplify left-hand side. So There is a trivial contribution which comes when I take the derivative of the phase. So it's I phi dot to the I phi psi k of t. But in principle, right, this wave function also depends on time. Right? So this tells me so formally I can write the I phi d by dt psi k of t. Now, clearly, this contribution is, so to say, geometrical, right? Because if I just had a scalar wave function, this is the part of the wave function which does not depend on time, right? So for the scalar case, this would be zero, right? And you could forget about it. But if you have something like a spinner, right? As quasi-momentum changes, the spinner can also change. So this derivative is actually non-zero, right? So, now I can now in order to solve it, so let me multiply it from the left by psi k of t, right, such that I can get rid of this wave function, then I would get minus phi dot. This one is just going to give me one, right, plus ih. And also let me get rid of these phases, right? So this I can. Plus IH psi k of t d by dt psi k of t should be equal to epsilon k of t. Okay? So then I can solve this equation for the phase, and I would find that the phase is equal to minus. First of all, there would be the trivial contribution which comes from this energy. So it would be epsilon k of t prime dt prime. But also there would be this contribution. So this is first one is dynamical phase, and it's called dynamical phase because you can see clearly that it depends on how, you know, you're moving adiabatically slowly, right? But still the rate at which you move affects this term, right? Which,
Sorry, just
Good, good, yeah.
Maybe would you mind explaining again why that
phase means? Yes, very good. So essentially, situation I'm considering is the following, right? So I put an electron in some quasi-momentum state, and then I move it adiabatically in the band. So what does it mean to be adiabatic? Right? It means that you stay in the same band, right? You don't go to any other excited band, right? So which tells you that at each point along the path you're staying in an eigenstate for a given quasi-momentum and a given band. And that's what I wrote, right? So I know that my instantaneous wave function must be proportional to the eigenstate. But you know, the two states are physically the same, right? They're allowed to have a different phase factor. That's what I wrote here. So I wrote some arbitrary phase, which I'm gonna now find, right, from the from the Schrödinger equation, essentially, right? So that's what I did. So this is quantity I want to find, and then using this equation, I can write this condition on the phase. Okay, so and then I find that in addition to the trivial dynamical phase, which we all know and expect and find boring, right? There is this very very non-trivial contribution.
So psi depends on k, and k changes in time.
Yes.
But then, why do we expect that that normally the derivative of that with respect to time would be zero? Because
yes, normally it would be zero. Oh. If it's a scalar wave function, it would be zero. But if it is, imagine if your wave function is a vector, right? Then, and imagine this vector rotates, right, as you move in the Brillouin zone. Then it doesn't have to be zero, right?
But I fail to see why it should be zero for a scalar. I must be overlooking something. But so if psi depends on k, mm-hmm. and k depends on time, mm-hmm. then I would expect psi to depend on time, even for a scalar. But
So your question is why is it?
Why is it normally not time dependent?
So, well, first of all, what do you mean by normally?
Oh, scalar.
Huh?
Scalar.
So if you just have, let's say, one. So what does scalar mean in this context? It means that you would have a lattice with a single atom per unit cell, right? So then you know that all your wave functions, right? If you have just single atom per unit cell, all your wave functions are just e to the I k r I, right? So now, of course, here, right, I should be thinking about not the trivial Bloch function, right? But I rather should be thinking about the what's standing in front of it, right? In this case, this is always one, right? Prefactor is always one, right? So this psi k, right? Psi k of t is always one, right? So that's why nothing changes, right? So this derivative is always zero. So, in general, you'll see that it's easiest to find non-trivial Beres phases when you have some spinner wave function, because then quite naturally you'll find that this is non-trivial. Mm-hmm. So now let's play with this term just a little bit. So more specifically, let's show that this term is independent on the rate at which I'm moving along this loop. And this is quite easy. This is because I could say that and here I forgot. So d by, no, this is okay, right? This is okay. So I could write d by dt psi k of t as a d by dk psi k, right, times dk by dt. Right, so which tells me that this term is really right. So let me call it geometrical phase. So it's IH integral dk psi k d by dk psi k. Okay. And when I come back to the same point, right, this becomes a closed loop integral. Mm-hmm. Right, so this is the Beres phase. Mm-hmm. So now we're out of time, unfortunately. But in the next 5 minutes, what I encourage you to do is to take spin 1/2, right? Or alternatively, take our example of graphene, right, and calculate the Beres phase for the trajectory when you're moving around the Dirac point. Okay, so that you can do very easily, and you would find that this Beres phase is non-trivial. So there are two equivalent formulations. So formulation one takes spin 1/2, considers the Bloch sphere, and imagine that you are varying magnetic field adiabatically in the xy plane, right, such that your spin 1/2 encloses the equator. And the second formulation is take, let's say, graphene, right? Put an electron in some quasi-momentum state, and then just drag it around the Dirac point, and calculate the Beres phase. So, and once you get this result, you would immediately link it to this picture, and you would see why. Essentially, these two trajectories acquire additional phase, which completely changes the interference. So let's stop here for today. Excuse me.
What? One should use the wave functions that are again functions of the motor.
Yes. Exactly. Yeah. Right. Mm-hmm. You guys make sense?
On the right-hand side of the second wall, so you started with a small phi. How do you get the capital phi?
Wait, why capital phi? So where did you see capital phi?
Your last form, the last line.
This one?
Yes.
This one.
No. What psi? Sorry.
Psi.
Capital psi. Sorry.
Uh huh. So well, I mean, my capital psi is here, right? So it's just the phase times this. Mm-hmm.
But I mean, the phase is time dependent.
Right? Yes. So that's why I have an integral, right, which runs until time. So if you want to find this phase, right, prescription is take this and integrate until the time at which you want to find the phase. Right?
Mm-hmm. So from the second to third line, you have d dt psi, mm-hmm. the second to third line.
This one?
No, the line above.
Second, this one.
So that's a third line, and the line above that is a second line. So you have DDT of small psi.
Yeah.
And then it became DDT of large psi, capital psi.
Yes, right. Yeah. Well, I mean, it's just taking a derivative, right? So you can take derivative of e to the phi or derivative of psi.
So here chirality of the wave function is not important.
It is. Why? It is. Well, I mean, it will. It's really the.
Ah, okay.
Right. It's really what makes this quantity non-zero. Okay, guys. Yeah, this is a difficult concept, but we'll spend some more time on this.